Hi, my name is Emily Barnes. I'm an alcoholic. Boy, this is a big group. It's just got to give your heart a little start, doesn't it, when you get up here? My name really is M.A., by the way. I should tell you this. It's a very boring story, but I'll tell you anyway. My grandmothers were named Mary and Alice, and they didn't like each other. And my parents decided to name me Mary Alice, and they had such a fit that they were naming me M.A. So that's, I told you it was boring. That's how I came across that name, and it's been okay till I got an Alcoholics Anonymous, and then people think I'm being doubly anonymous, so I just tell them I'm M.A. Barnes and I'm anonymous on the wrong end. That's kind of the way I did things in my life anyway. I'd like to thank Clancy for asking me to speak tonight. It really is a privilege. I recently moved in with Elsa C., Chuck C.'s widow, in Laguna Beach. And that's one of the great, great privileges of my life also, is to know Chuck C. And I get to every morning to sit in his chair and look out his window, and, life is not too bad. But I was thinking this morning, knowing I was going to come down here, about the first time I ever spoke in Alcoholics Anonymous. Chuck called me up and asked me to speak for him one time, and I was about a year sober. And I said, I can't talk for you. You know, I've never spoken, you know, a whole hour in AA before. And he said, as he always did, well, you can if you do. So I went over. I did. I went over to the Garden Grove, Alano, and this place was absolutely packed. There were just people. Tour buses came. I swear they did. They came in gurneys and IV bottles, and they were the halt and the lame, and they were all coming out. They let them out of jails. Everyone came to hear Chuck C. talk. And the whole podium was just carpeted with tape recorders. And before coffee break, when they announced Chuck C. wasn't going to be there, the whole room went, like that. And after coffee break and I came out, all the tape recorders were gone, and about half the room was gone. And I got to give my very first AA pitch. And I told Chuck C. about that the next morning, and he said, he said, nothing's ever going to scare you again in AA, is it? And I said, no, I guess not. Stop until tonight, nothing did. So anyway, I guess after that illustrious beginning, he always used to say, you know your own story best. And I've always said that I was born a Southern Baptist. That's as good a reason to drink as I ever came up with, And my family was a, they were a great disappointment to me. My family just seemed to, they didn't have any fire or any flash to them. You know, there was no, and I always had this very active mind. And wherever I was, I always liked things the way they aren't. I always was looking over the next hill, and it was a pretty rigid family. I don't know if it was the time or whether it was the religion or whether it was my perception of what was going on, but I always felt real restricted in it. I always felt like I couldn't share what I was thinking or I couldn't share what I was feeling. And it was kind of the thing that you didn't talk about things outside the family. It just wasn't done. You know, it would bring shame on the family. I have an aunt that to this day she fans herself, and she says, "What the very idea?" So that was kind of what I grew up in. It was pretty restrictive, and I had this busy mind, and I used to sit there and wonder. I'd read magazines and things, and I think, God, I wonder how you get from where I am to be editor of Vogue magazine, or ambassador to Sweden, or advisor to the president. I didn't want to be sitting there, and I didn't want to do the just dial tone kind of life that it seemed that everyone was living. And some years later, I saw a play called The Fantastics, and there was a song in there where the young man sings it, where he's talking about the bright lights. He can see them shining, and he just has to go. You know, there's kind of fire inside. And I really identified with that. And the character in there also, the play's experience, says the bright lights will burn also. And he says he doesn't care. He has to go anyway. And that's kind of the way I always felt about things, because I just knew that I had to get up and go. I really didn't fit in my family. I didn't feel that I fit. I learned real early on, too, that if I could get the right costume on, if I could look right on the outside, then I could fool just about anybody that was going on. So I always had this kind of mental picture. I had all these series of Halloween costumes in my closet. You know, I could be the respectable woman, or I could be the mother, or I could be the lady of the evening, or I could be the churchgoer, you know. But I always, that was another disease from which I suffer. My grandmother taught me that one. That was keeping up appearances. I don't know how many of you suffered from that one, but it was, she used to say, at all costs, we must keep up appearances. And sometimes, like alcoholism, that'll kill you, you know, because I kept up appearances to the point it almost killed me, too. But I remember I used to go to church, and God, that was dull. Oh, God, it was dull. And, you know, and I've got a real dirty mind. I've always had a dirty mind. I've had a lot of fun with it. Actually, it's been more entertaining than life at different times, but... Yeah, I learned that real early on. You know, I used to sit in church and I used to look out and wonder what everybody would look like naked, you know. And I still do that. This is a great looking bunch. Bunch of you. He relaxes me, you know. But anyway, I had these kind of feelings real early on, and not being a smart alecky about that, but I always, because I thought the things I thought and felt the way that I felt, I always felt like I was something bad and wrong with me. And so I learned to keep up this little facade, this appearance out there, and had this whole inner life going on that I couldn't share with anybody for any reason. I became a writer very early on, and I wondered, you know, in retrospect, if maybe part of that writing wasn't because I didn't have anybody to talk to, and I couldn't express myself another way. So I learned to write real early on. I remember my dad saying of me, too, that... I didn't seem to fit in this family too much, and I remember him saying to me that I sure wasn't very pretty, but I was awful bright, and it was a good thing because I probably wouldn't get married. And you know, I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't have to live by other people's indictments, you know, but I didn't know that then. I had a very unclear picture of who I was. I didn't know what my values were, and I had these kind of two personalities going on in life, and I used to take what other people would say about me and kind of make them come true. I was in AA a while before I learned out I was not that funny looking, nor was I that bright. But you know, I didn't know that for a lot of years. I suppose it's just as well. So when everyone else in my family all got married, I went off to college. And I liked that. In the midst of all this thou shalt not and this very rigid kind of upbringing that I came from, my mother, funny enough, was an alcoholic. And she died an alcoholic. And yet I came, like most of us, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous thinking that alcoholics were skid row drunks, you know. And at the same time, I'd watched my mother die of alcoholism. She was a periodic. And so I was raised in that kind of crazy-making situation where we tried to keep up appearances and everything's supposed to look so good on the outside, and yet I never really knew what I was going to walk into at home. And my mother was, well, she's like every alcoholic I have come to know. Of course, I didn't know that at the time because I only knew her. But she was like every alcoholic in that she could be wonderful and warm and kind at different times. And then when she was drinking, she was, God, she was scary. She was really scary. I was actually afraid of my mother. I don't know how many of you have seen 101 Dalmatians, that Cruella de Vil. Do you remember her? When I was little, that's the way I perceived my mother. When I saw that movie, I kind of went, you know, because there she was. That was the way I saw her when she drank. And so I was really scared of my mother and blamed her for an awful lot of things for a lot of years. And before I get off of that, I want to say I was, she died while I was still drinking. And at the time, I was really not sorry that she died. I'm not proud to tell you that, but I really wasn't, because she had been just such a grievance and such an embarrassment and such a shame in all these years. I'd kind of disowned her for years. And really hadn't had much to do with her. I'd pay her taxes and stuff and things like that, but I hadn't really had much to do with her. And I was kind of glad when it was over. I was still drinking. I was glad that I could lay that part of things down. And I was about, maybe 2 years sober, much later on. I want to mention that before I get off of it, that I think I kind of made an amend in a way, even though she was dead. At that time, as I became sober and came to understand myself, I came to understand her. And I'll tell you, when I did that, I finally mourned her death a little bit, and I let go of an awful lot of that I'd carried around, because I blamed her for an awful lot of things. Blamed her for the way I viewed life and a lot of the things that I did. But anyway, that was another one of those things that just didn't seem to make sense in my family, that there was all this rigidity and no one could go for help desk to help my mother. We didn't know. We blamed her for things. And she died alcoholic, as I said. It's a hideous thing to watch. If you've never seen it, I can't explain it to you. And if you have seen it, you know what I mean. It's an awful thing to see. And so that was always in my mind. So, of course, I never wanted to be, you know, like my mother. I went off to college, and I loved college. I had fun. I found all the things I couldn't do at home, you know, and I just went crazy. You know, I was finally loose. I was finally let loose, and I got to do some of the things that I wanted to do, and I was a pretty good scholar, and found boys and drinking and alcohol and smoking. I took to all of it just like that, and thoroughly enjoyed it all. I was also writing, and I didn't have very much money. My dad kept me pretty broke in school, and so I started writing, which at that time was sort of popular, True Confessions. I don't know how many of you remember those. I don't know if they're still out there or not. And I wrote under MA, of course, and they wrote back. They thought I was a guy, and they said, well, you have a real light touch to your writing. Why don't you kind of juice this up a little bit, spice it up, make it more exciting. So I did, and I ended up writing porno when I was in college. Mine was kind of fun. I'll tell you, if you're not very popular and you don't have much fun, it's kind of fun to do on a Saturday night. My son is here tonight. I may have to send him home. He doesn't know some of this. If I tell an honest story, he may have to go home. At any rate, that was one of those things, and it was that old getting away with things that I just loved. I've loved it all my life in drinking. You know, I was thinking, God, wouldn't my family just die? You know, here I finally went off to school, and now I'm drinking and smoking and writing porno, and there was a part of me that just said, you know, I just... You know, I've gotten away with it. And yet, it's the other time there's the same old, you know, the very idea kind of thing. Yeah. That has always been a part. It seems like I operate on two opposite, you know, extremes all the time. There's part of me that it's an old stuffed shirt, and part of me that's just goofy, just crazy. And everything I've ever done, there's always been this pull both ways, and they've always been real equal in me. And I've never, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, those things have kind of come together a little bit for me, but there's always been these two things that have operated in me. I read the book Sybil, you know, before I got sober one time, about a multiple personality, and I really identified with that too, because I thought it told in the book about how she would sort of come to in a situation, and the personality that was there had no way of handling the situation she came to in, and then that personality would get into another situation, and then another personality would come out. And I identified with that so much, and I thought, well, maybe that's what my problem is, because I would do that. I would come to in a situation that I couldn't handle and didn't know how to do it. Didn't know for a long time it was alcoholism. I got married anyway, when I was in school. I married a Yankee, And once again, there was part of me really wanted that marriage to work. I really, really wanted to be like everybody else and have the house and the pie on the windowsill and all those things. Because I can do that. You know, I know how to do those things. And it was pretty clear pretty early on that I just couldn't do it, at least at that point in my life. Because there was always that hill I had to go over, those lights that I had to go after. And I had two sons as a result of that marriage. And somewhere down the line, I finally thought, you know, marriage is just not for me. I had that old play-acting feeling again, like I had in so many things in the church. And again, in marriage, I was feeling that phony feeling that I can get it on the outside, but it's not working. So I took my two sons, and I left my husband, and I went to Cleveland, which is really where my drinking started. I had drunk up to that point, and I hadn't drank normally. Someone was talking about blackouts tonight. I drank with blackouts. But the drinking was not really a huge problem until, you know, I finally went to Cleveland, and I became involved in this big corporation. I started as a writer, and I started moving my way up the corporate ladder. And I found the corporate world very exciting. And at the same time, I fell in love the first time. I called it love then. I'd call it obsession today. I know a little more. It was just a hell of a love affair. And he was an artist, and I was a writer. And I was just very much in love. And we did a lot of good things for the company, and we started a cartoon strip together that's still running. And we probably would have gotten married, except he already was. I told you I was bright. If any of you are into severe pain, I recommend going out with a married man. It's the finest vehicle I have ever found for suffering and drinking and the Al-Anon salute. And you can... You can lie to your friends and lie to your business associates and lie to yourself and spend holidays alone, and you can suffer. Oh, God, I suffered, and magnificently. And it's, you know, this went on for about 11 years, and this is where the whole drinking thing came to. That's how bright I was. It took a long time for me. And as I was moving up the corporate ladder, this was going on, and it was kind of an exciting time in life. But at the same time, the drinking had really begun. It was drinking at lunch and dinner, and then I worked with artists and writers, and they smoked dope, and so I joined them, and Timothy Leary was a big hero at the time. What an unlikely hero for a whole generation he was, but he was our hero, and everyone I knew took acid. I didn't know anyone who didn't take acid. It was not at that time because it was a drug. It was for awareness. You know, and it was funny how I compartmentalized what I was doing, because I drank and I didn't want to be too alcoholic like my mother, so that was going on, and I smoked pot, but that was just for fun times. That wasn't drugs, and acid occasionally, and by that time I was into tranquilizers and sleeping pills, and it was just better living through chemistry. It was just awful, you know, and trying to keep going and getting down too far and having to come back up, and going to bed at night and having too much speed, you know, and I couldn't sleep, so I just, you know, wake up with my own hands around my own throat, you know, just going, anxiety attacks, I've come to know that they are, and then have to go back to sleep. So do you smoke dope or do you drink, or, you know, what do you do to get back to sleep? And I'd gotten on a real fast track. I was raising my children, I was trying to be perfect in that. I bought this huge house just to be okay, to look okay, and had this huge car and this big job, and I was really... My kids used to say that my car looked determined. I'd go plowing through the snow in Cleveland and coming on and late everywhere I went. And I was into playing Wonder Woman. I was trying to keep this big job going, and I was trying to keep this romance going. And I remember somewhere reading that anything you pour alcohol on will dissolve. I think it was talking about a tooth or something at the time. But I thought about that. You know, my life was dissolving. That relationship was dissolving and should have been. Emotional stability was dissolving. A whole lot of things were dissolving, and I could not see it as alcohol. That was my problem. I really didn't know that I had a problem. I was on this real fast track, as I say, and I was trying to be everything to everybody. And there were those times when I wasn't taking anything that I would hurt so bad, and I would be so afraid, you know, when I wasn't on anything or I was coming down from something, that I couldn't face life on life's terms. And so it was that never-ending thing. I would have to go back to drugs and alcohol to maintain my sanity and maintain the pace I was running and maintain all those things. And hurting, really, really inside, just hurting. They called alcoholism the lonely disease. And people said MA stood for Magnificent Android. And that's kind of the way I felt often. I felt like an android. It was like, for years I had just pushed emotions down, and I pushed them down at home. I remember having an alcoholic mother. We used to get punished pretty heavily, you know, and I don't know how many of you did this, but I, somehow when I got punished, I could not cry. Because if I cried, I lost. I don't know if you understand that. It was like if I cried and broke down, that they broke my spirit. It broke me, you know. And so I grew up with that real rigid, you know, you can hurt me, but you can't make me cry. And I brought that along with me too, you know. I've always kind of been that way, hanging on to those emotions. And in AA, I have finally learned to be a little bit vulnerable, a little bit open, which is, you know, a great gift of, you know, you can't live with your emotions as dead as mine are. Things are going so bad in this relationship. They looked okay on the surface. I can always keep up appearances. But things are going very badly on the inside. And my sons were swimmers, and I kept being told I should come out to Mission Viejo, and so they could swim under the best coach. And so I did. I came out to Mission Viejo. It's been about 11 or 12 years now, something like that. And I knew that once I got to California, I'd be okay. I'd be away from the pressure of the job and the pressure of this man and the pressure of this big school and all these things. And I knew I'd be okay out here in California. I used to stand down in Laguna Beach and look at the ocean and think I could be okay here. And when I got here, I really found out my problem was portable. You know, I'm glad I did it. I know that's a geographic now, but I'm glad that I came out here and saw that without the man and without the job and without all those pressures, I had come out here with some writing contracts and this cartoon strip, so I had a big income. And once again, it looked good. I had a nice house, and my kids all had cars and the swimming pool, and I had all this stuff. And that terrible sadness inside and that terrible loneliness. And I didn't know a soul in California. I used to call Mission Viejo Barbie and Kenville, you know, and Clonesville. And it was really kind of pretty. And my sons were doing beautifully. And oh, I forgot to mention this man and I also had a daughter, Julie, who's 17 years old today. And she's an absolutely beautiful little girl. I am so thrilled that Julie's in my life. But it was, you know, to have had her when this man and I had her, it was one of those other things of thumbing my nose at the world. I've often done the right things for the wrong reasons, and Julie's a real good example of that because she's added so much to my life, but at the time it was kind of manipulation, and it was, again, the two polarities. I loved her, and it was a manipulation. So anyway, I had these three kids out here in California, and things were going along well, and I was not going well. And I'd been here about a year or so, and I... my oldest son had applied to some Eastern colleges, and they send out simultaneous mailings on whether you are in or you're not. And I bought a big bottle of booze, and I said, we'll either celebrate or we'll drown our sorrows, you know, to see whether he got in or not. And the mail came, and he got in. He got in several of these colleges, and Harvard was one of them, and that's where he went off to. And we had this drink, you know, all of us, my kids and I, and we all had this drink, and I came to that morning. Like I did so many mornings, I was sitting up in the middle of my bed, hanging onto my knees, saying, you know, my God, what's the matter with me? What happened? How did I get here? You know, because I've always had so many ideals and so many dreams, and I suppose under all that stuff, you know, there's still that romantic person that knew life was really neat and beautiful, and I just squeezed the life out of life, and I didn't have any friends, and I kept waking up in bed, you know, just so damn lonely and so afraid. And I thought, you know, here I should, I've got everything, it all looks good out here, you know, we're keeping up appearances, and there's something real wrong. I've got everything to be happy about, and I'm not happy. I had done what my family said to be happy, and it didn't work. I had a cousin who had made an amend to me one time for her drunken phone calls that she had made to me in Cleveland, and she made that amend, and I didn't listen to the amend really at the time. I was busy, and I said, yeah, good, and I'm at the phone, and I thought, God, I'm glad she's sober. She was really a pain, you know, and didn't think again about that phone call until that particular morning. And on that particular morning, I called her at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I said, you know, Elaine, there's something real wrong with me, and I'm afraid it's alcohol. First time I had ever really admitted that I had a problem with alcohol, and it was from there that I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of those that felt good here from the beginning. And I remember thinking, God, wouldn't it be nice if this place is for real? You know, at my first meeting, I was thinking, I knew there was a catch to it somewhere. I knew somebody would want me to tithe 10% like the church did or something. And for the newcomers that are here, there isn't a catch to this. This thing is for real, and it's a kind of an organization. I belong to a lot of organizations. This is the kind of thing I've looked for all my life. It's fabulous. And I came to AA, and I liked it, and I was sober about, 30 days, something like that. And my sponsor said, what are those pills you take? I said, nothing of speed and tranquilizers and sleeping pills and medically indicated. And she told me that I didn't have one day of sobriety till I gave up those pills. And so I gave up the pills if I drank, and I could do that. And I gave up drinking if I took the pills, and I could not give them. First time I knew I was dually addicted to all of it. For me, those pills were powdered alcohol. So I put myself in the care unit and finally got sober and changed my sobriety date to July of 78. And I, thank God, have not had to take a mind-altering chemical since or of any kind. As I said, I have really loved AA. I've always had good, strong sponsorship, and that has been real important to me. And about 5 years ago, I'd gotten real firm in AA. I got right in the middle of AA in Laguna Beach and was pretty comfortable. And I'd learned to like living, and I'd learned to like the serenity. Someone said serenity is not the absence of problems, it's the presence of God. And I really liked that, you know, and I had gotten some serenity. And I knew that this thing with this man in Cleveland was an absolute mess, and that I had to do some things about it. I talked to some people on the program. My taxes were fraud. Everything was a mess, and I had some things I had to straighten out there. Because when they say in AA you have to change everything, it means everything, not just everything, but you've got to get in and change everything. And when it started really bothering me, I finally knew that I had to do something about this. And at that time, when I tried to talk to this man, for reasons of his own, he got real rigid and would not give on any of these points, and we ended up in a lawsuit. And I got to tell you, that was the most awful thing I have ever been through in my life. That was about 5 years ago. At that time, too, my then sponsor, Colleen W., was quite ill, and she had asked me to get another sponsor. And so I became involved with the Pacific Group at that point because I needed help. I got involved in this lawsuit, and I heard from other people. You know, Chuck C. talked about not getting involved in a lawsuit. He told the man that took $500,000 away from him one time. He said to him, "Victor, the money means more to you than it means to me. You keep it." And I knew that story. I knew that Chuck hadn't gone to court. But, you know, like a lot of my life, I thought my case is different. And so I went to court. I got what I thought was a gentleman lawyer, and we went off to do this thing. And the law is different. My dad was a lawyer, and the law is different than it used to be. And the first thing I experienced was my income, because my income was all tied in through this and this whole thing, my income went to zero in one day. Boy, I'll tell you, that's harsh. And, you know, I had a lot of bills, and I had a lot of houses, and I had cars, and I had all this stuff, and I had zero income in one day. And I went back to work typing for $4 an hour, you know, because I had to do those things. And everything that I had accumulated over my lifetime started to go. The houses and the cars, even the furs and the jewelry and everything went. And they had to foreclose on the house. And I got forced into bankruptcy. And all this time this lawsuit is going on. And that's the most awful thing I have ever been through. You know, being born Baptist, I think I was born guilty anyway. You know, and to go through these things where the lawyers are just grinding on you for 8 hours a day, and I felt like a criminal. But the first time in my life, I started thinking about drinking, and I hadn't thought about drinking in a long time. When I'd be driving up to Los Angeles to go to these depositions, I'd start thinking, "God, if I just had some Valium, just some social Valium, just to get me through this." What I want to say, especially to the new people, I lost all that stuff, but I'll tell you, I did not lose anything of value. The things that I had come to value over those first 5 years of sobriety, I didn't lose. And those were the things that I really had to fight for, because I started waking up in the morning afraid to go through the day. And my sponsor helped me through that. I would call him every day, and I would say, "What do I do today?" And a lot of times it was real simple direction, but I needed that at the time, because I was so filled with anxiety and terror, and I had missed the thing I come to treasure, you know, to wake up in the morning and think, "God, it's a great day and I'm going to go out there." I was waking up in the morning saying, "I want to live. I can't go through another day of this. These lawyers were just beating me to pieces." And my lawyers were, I'd gotten a gentleman lawyer, and this didn't turn out to be a gentlemanly thing. I had a private eye following me around. And I did this for about 3 years. And I remember Chuck always used to say that if the whole world approves and your insides don't approve, you're not approved. And I started looking at that statement again, because I was starting to get really physically sick. I was having female problems and dental problems and all kinds of, my physical health was going. And I was getting afraid, and I was trying to work and get this lawsuit together and go through this badgering and bullying, and it was hideous. And I realized that if I'd have stuck with it 5 years, I might have had a lot of money, but I think I'd have been dead in 3 years, because my body was just collapsing on me. And the things that I came to value here in AA were starting to go little by little. And I will say that I did not have to go through 1 minute of that by myself. The people in AA walked with me every step of the way. People in Laguna and people out of this group stood by me. I remember Barney M. talking one time where he said, it was real important to me when I heard that, where he said that who he was not what he had or what he did. And I kept hanging on to that statement a whole lot, because, you know, I had lost everything, and I'd lost all my status was going and all this. And part of me knew, I guess, intellectually, that these things didn't matter. But when I started losing them, I started losing a lot of self-esteem with it, too, and I got real afraid. And it was the people in AA that really shored me up and let me know that it isn't those things, you know, that are so important, but rather it's me, and that they loved me for what I was. No, not in spite of what I was, but for what I was. And I'll tell you, that's a beautiful lesson to learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm okay just like I am. You know, I don't have to have all that stuff. And like I said, I was so afraid to walk through those things without all the stuff that I had accumulated. And I really, I haven't missed a meal. I moved to Laguna Beach, you know, when I lost my home. I started putting my life back together, and But I said, I've been a writer almost all my life, and during those 5 years, I just did whatever I could do. You know, I typed, I did escrow, I did stuff I'd never even heard of before. And I landed into some really nice jobs, you know, I really kind of enjoyed them. But recently, I just, pray for me, I went back to writing again. I just began, just in the last few months, and I've started writing again. And the whole feeling of the writing is all different than it used to be. I remember when I threw that lawsuit down, it really was just kind of like Chuck had said. I finally said, you know, the money means more to you than it means to me. You keep it. And everything inside of me just kind of went, ah, God, thank God. And my insides approved. And so part of me wants to say that I'm a terrible coward for throwing that whole thing down. And part of me knows that it was really the right thing. It really beat me to pieces, though, and it's been kind of a long, hard row for me to come back from that and to really feel as good about everything as I did before. And I think what I would have done if I would have gone through that lawsuit, you know, without you people there to help me, and in losing everything without you people to help me. They said my son is here tonight who went through a whole lot of my alcoholism with me. Both my sons had graduated from college from that time. They both went to Harvard, and my daughter got in that lawsuit. I got my taxes paid. Thank God those were not forgivable. I got my daughter's education paid for, and that was okay. And I got the lawyers paid for, and that was it. And I kind of walked away free, and I'll tell you, I walked away a free person. I had always kind of been connected to Cleveland. I'd always kind of been on these strings before, and also I think another thing that I learned is a lot of my macho fell off, if you will. You know, I got real vulnerable because the first time in my life I had to ask for help. I'd always had this position where I could help you, but I could never ask for help. And I did. I had to call people up and ask for help, and I had to get rides to meetings, and I had to ask people for their advice because I didn't know. And asking for help has made me a little softer and a little more vulnerable, which is something I've always wanted to be, because I learned to be a smartass real early, because that keeps people away from me, and that's the last thing in the world I ever wanted to do. I want to thank Clancy for asking me to speak. It's a huge privilege to speak here at the Pacific Group, and I thank you all for your love and support, and I hope I can always be here for you if I can help. Thank you.
And all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to